Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Counting down the final days of the year. And I have scheduled for you on the 1st, on New Year's Day, our annual Year in Review podcast. Just going to take a look back at some of the biggest stories of the last 12 months. In January, going to do some cool stuff. I'm having Dr. Abby Hafer back to talk about the not-so-intelligent designer. We're always hearing about intelligent design and how there's proof everywhere of design in nature. And Dr. Hafer is going to point out that, you know, if God was behind this, he really needs to be spoken to. Like, we really need to ask him some questions. What were you thinking? What's this about? This is not intelligent at all, with a lot of specific examples. So if you're involved in discussions, it's going to be a handy resource for you. We're going to talk about atheism and ego and the charges that many people say, you're so arrogant. Whenever we challenge God claims, I've got Dr. Anthony Penn. We're going to talk about religious trauma syndrome and a whole lot more coming up in the weeks ahead. And thanks to our listeners who have provided so many great suggestions for show topics. And if you have one for the new year, just email podcast@thethinkingatheist.com. Today's podcast made possible through the support of my amazing patrons. And you can be a patron as well at patreon.com/SethAndrews. Now, you may be looking at the title of this show and wondering what I'm doing. Seth, this is the Thinking Atheist Radio Podcast. Why are you doing a show about Bitcoin? Well, first of all, it fascinates me. Secondly, I don't understand it, and I really do want to. And thirdly, I've been doing this show since 2010, and even I like to talk about other things. And you can only say there is no evidence for any gods anywhere so many times in so many ways. Now, we've beaten that dead horse. Certainly, we're going to keep religious issues and atheism front and center. But as you will notice in the months and years ahead, I'm probably going to stretch the boundaries just a little bit more as we talk about some other things. You know, directing our skepticism to life stuff. And Bitcoin is all over the headlines. It's everywhere. I'm seeing documentaries about it. I don't understand it. It's supposedly the next big thing. What the hell is Bitcoin? Well, to help educate us and solve the mystery, I've got a wildly entertaining guy and a financial guru. His name is Phil Ferguson of Polaris Financial Planning. He's a friend. He's an atheist activist. If you think talk about finances has to be boring, you have not met Phil Ferguson, who likes to litter pretty much every conversation with swear words and attitude, and it's just awesome. And there's a video of this exchange. If you want to watch it on YouTube, that link is in the description box of this podcast. Just click it. You can pull it up on YouTube. I began the exchange by asking Phil Ferguson to introduce himself.
Well, my name is Phil Ferguson. My podcast is the cleverly titled The Phil Ferguson Show, available on all good bookstores, podcast players. And of course, I am a evangelical atheist, secular activist. I've been involved with the movement for about 12 years, and my business is Polaris Financial Planning. I've been providing financial services for about 22 years. So that's a little background on me.
Now, for those who are saying, we have a slightly kind of glitchy connection here via Skype. We're not sure what that's about. We're aware of it, but I was glad to have Phil on the air anyway. And I think it's a compelling enough topic. Yeah, we're going to get to Bitcoin. By the way, did you go see the new Star Wars movie yet?
I actually did just a day or two ago. Do you want to talk about that?
No spoilers, but yes, no, thumbs up, thumbs down.
I'm conflicted. How's that? There's a complicated answer for you. There are some things that I liked about it because almost every Star Wars movies I've ever seen, I sit in the theater and the lights go down and the sound comes up. And after 10 commercials, the movie starts and I'm fucking back in fourth grade. And when that first one came out, and it's a happy place, you know, it's Star Wars. Yeah. With the exception of Jar Jar Binks, I like all of them.
Oh God.
But
no, we can't be friends. You like the prequel films? We can't be friends.
I like them all.
I'm disconnecting this interview. Because, right. Where's the button? You
know, like I said, it's that throwback to my childhood.
All right.
Things were simple and every answer was just, it's okay. It's going to be okay. But there were some things in the movie, and I'll throw out one thing that should not be a big surprise to anybody. There are some additional cutesy creatures that are in the movie that are clearly put in there so that Disney can sell toys in the coming years. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I think that's obvious. And that was a little over the top, but you know,
I look back at my childhood. And I said this just the other day online, it was like 1977, Star Wars comes out, and we were not a movie going family. Oh, we'll get back to finances here in a minute, but, you know, we just never went. My dad couldn't hear; he was deaf, and so he couldn't enjoy the dialogue in the films. We'd just sit in the theater and try to read lips. It was just maddening for him. But he said, "Hey, Seth, would you like to go see Star Wars?" I'm 9 years old, and it was a transformative moment, right? It just marked my youth and ignited in me this love of storytelling. And so I sort of carry that with me. And I have the same feeling. You sit down in the theater, and the music swells, and the Star Wars logo comes up, and all is well with the universe. But
I also have an additional bonding thing with my son. When he was very, very young, we would watch episodes 4, 5, and 6, the first three movies on Laserdisc. So I had them before they were redone, you know, Han shot first kind of stuff.
You still have them?
No, I ended up giving them away to a charity because Laserdiscs are close to worthless. I know that the three of those together might have been worth $40, but
Think about some of the early Star Wars toys we had as children, if we'd have hung on to them in their original packaging, right? I mean, I would not need a financial advisor.
Phil. Then you would never get to play with them. And what kind of kid wants that childhood?
That shit would be on eBay tonight. And then, you know, I'm going to have a car in the driveway with the big bow on the top.
What was interesting is my son and I, we'd watch these movies over and over and over. And there's that one scene where Darth Vader and Luke are fighting, and it's the big reveal. I don't want to give any too many spoilers, but Darth Vader cuts off Luke's hand, and my son, who's, you know, 5 or 6, loses his shit and just starts uncontrollably bawling. And it was one of those things that you realize that children can understand things on different levels every different month or every different year as they age. And all of a sudden he realized that it's not just pretty blinking colors and flashing lights and nice sound effects and music. Luke lost his hand from his own dad. And it just freaked him out. And so we couldn't watch it for a good year after that. But
screwed up your kid, Phil. Yeah, that's hardcore, man.
He's like, I want to go back and watch it again.
But the eyes of a child. We did the same thing for Halloween. We had all these Halloween decorations. I had this 6-foot skeleton, this sort of animatronic skeleton in the front. And I've got a 3-year-old. Who came by, and you know, to me, it's like, oh, look, it's an animatronic skeleton. And he saw agency, intelligence in this thing, and he didn't want to go near it. And so from then on, whenever he would come over, he would be like, oh, you know, where's the skeleton man? And I'd be like, he's okay. He's up in the attic. You're safe. He's not anywhere near. He's in a box. Okay. Where's the skeleton man? And to him, it was like this bigger than life thing. And I had to remind myself of what it was like when you're a kid and everything is more real than real, you know? We talk about perceptions and reality in terms of what we do in the marketplace. Bitcoin is supposed to be the next big thing. It's supposed to be
thing now
transforming how we do currency. I've watched I don't know how many segments on Bitcoin, and every time I think I get it, I then realize I don't. Like, mining for Bitcoin. What? Someone give me a primer on this, Phil. What the hell is Bitcoin? Okay.
I started posting some things on Facebook about Bitcoin, and oh my Lord, it was like what the average American might get when they post something negative about religion. And I was getting attacked. I was getting arguments. I now have lost friends, Facebook friends, and some of them genuine, real people that I know in person, friends on Facebook, because of this. And so I said, I'm fascinated by this. Why this visceral response? Why can't we just look at it at numbers and objectivity? And of course, it's even going to be difficult for me to do this. So I started looking into it, and I've probably spent 40 hours in the last couple of weeks researching this, because I've heard of Bitcoin and I wasn't interested in it. And I thought, if I'm going to start talking about this and addressing questions and concerns, I better at least know a little bit. So I, by no way am an expert, but I watched YouTube video after YouTube video, and we're talking, some of these guys are one step away from Illuminati. I'm not saying it's aliens, but.
No, you're not saying everybody who's involved in Bitcoin is a tinfoil hat guy.
No, not all of them. No.
Oh, but, God. The hate mail is already coming in. I can hear the inbox swelling.
And it's also very popular among people that have a big distrust of government. And I don't know that they're completely unjustified in that distrust, especially with what Republicans are doing. I know these are just my opinions and not necessarily those of the show, but I can see a little bit of perspective from where they're coming from. Also a little bit of a libertarian thing where, you know, we can rely and do everything ourselves and not involve the government.
Okay. Well, I guess that's the point where we say what you are hearing, what you've heard, what you may be about to hear does not constitute financial advice. Yeah. This is not the truth with a capital T. This is opinion.
You must be psychic. I have a little list here. I was just like, I better get to my list.
It's your list.
My list is never invest in anything you do not understand. So if you don't understand Bitcoin, just don't. There's other ways to make money. If something appears too good to be true, it probably is. This is not investment advice. I am not recommending that you buy or sell Bitcoins or any other cryptocurrency. I am not an expert in the code or the mathematics behind Bitcoin, and I do not own, I never have owned, I'm not short, and I will never own or short Bitcoins. So my intent is to try to look at this like I do other things on my show, objectively, and it's a very difficult thing to do as humans, especially when I see concerns, but I don't want to get to the concerns first. I want to make sure that people kind of have a understanding of Bitcoin. Does that sound okay?
Now, before we get into that, though, I can already see the criticisms. They're saying, well, if you're just now dipping your toe in the water, if you're just now examining it, maybe you're not qualified to criticize.
It's a fair point. I'm way more qualified now than I was 2 weeks ago.
But you speak the language of currency and finance, the larger picture.
And one of the things, if I make a grotesque analogy, and every analogy breaks down if you analyze it too much. But when the emperor was walking down the street with his new clothes, I didn't know anything about magical threads, but I could still tell the dude is naked. And so from that level, I can look at Bitcoin. But if someone really wants to get into the algorithms behind creating cryptography, I'm a complete noob. I have no idea how that works. I'm not sure I really understand it. So there are certain things that people are going to be able to critique and comment and correct me and say that I'm wrong. No doubt about it. I thought of the famous phrase, and I'm going to modify it. Anyone that says they know everything about Bitcoin doesn't know Bitcoin. It's complicated. There's a lot of stuff in this, and I'm going to have some things wrong. And I do welcome corrections if they're polite. I learn things. I learn new things. It's the flying off the handle evangelical. Like someone told me that Bitcoin made them $2,000 in the last year, which I will accept from them as an empirical fact. And what kind of drove me into this is they told me that I should be recommending to all of my clients that they put 10% of their money in Bitcoin, and that if I do not, I am not acting as a prudent fiduciary, that I am in violation of the law. I was like, what the hell are you talking about?
Meaning if the opportunity is that great and you didn't turn your clients onto it, you're neglectful.
And I tried to explain to them that simply because they made, and they never say 20 times, they always say 2,000% because it's a much bigger number. That's the same number, but it sounds bigger. That someone could go to a racetrack, bet on a horse, and win 20 times the amount that they bet, that doesn't make it an investment. It's still betting. Is Bitcoin like that? We're going to dig into that a little bit. The other analogy that I like to make is when someone says, I donated $100 to Jesus, and then a year later, I got an unexpected check for $2,000. you should give $100 to Jesus because you'll make $2,000 too.
You never see the losers on the church marquee billboard, just like you don't see the losers on the casino billboards, only the winners, you know.
That's right. So it's a lot like gambling. I started off with a pretty hard position of saying that Bitcoin is neither a currency nor an investment. I have now modified the first part of that. Bitcoin, I think, is a currency. It's a really shitty currency. And the reason I'll say that is that, Seth, if you have $20 and you have it in your hand, and a month from now, what is that going to be worth?
You tell me.
About 20 bucks. I mean, there's inflation, depreciation, but it's about 20 bucks.
I mean, 20 bucks, not invested, just 20 bucks in my hand.
$20 bill in your hand. Okay. A month from now, it's worth about $20. If you have a Bitcoin or a fraction, an incredibly small fraction now of a Bitcoin that's worth $20, what's it going to be worth in a month? I don't know. So it makes it less valuable. So actually, the more it becomes like a speculation, the less it becomes like a currency. So it actually, by succeeding in having a run-up in price and an incredible volatility that's come with it, it actually performs less like a currency and becomes, in my mind, less valuable. But I'm kind of getting ahead of myself.
Let me drag us backward into the framework. What is Bitcoin? Like, if you were to take an idiot like myself and say, this is what it is over coffee.
I mean, I knew you'd play that role because that's good. I appreciate it.
That's my gift, right? I'm the guy. I'm the guy who I need small words. Use your hands when you talk to me. What the hell is Bitcoin?
So the first thing I feel obligated to mention is that it was created by a guy or a consortium of people with the name Satoshi Nakamoto. Okay. Now I've said it. Now we're going to move on because it's completely meaningless. No one knows who this person is or group of people is, and it doesn't affect anything else, but they throw his name around like he's a deity. So I've got that out of the way.
I thought that was an odd thing. Like, why the anonymity? Why can no one pin down who this person's real identity really is?
I don't know. And of course, there's questions about how much this person or this group of people have in Bitcoins. And do they have some kind of motivation to encourage its value to go up so they can eventually at some point cash out, or have they been cashing out all along the way? I have none of that information. So it's just a kind of a odd thing.
So some figure, some faceless pseudonym, someone somewhere started Bitcoin and their identity is not, and so far cannot be known.
That is my understanding. There's people in the know, but I tried. But so Bitcoin is a way to go outside of what a lot of fans of Bitcoin will use, fiat currency. Are you familiar with what a fiat currency is?
What, that's controlled by and run by governments?
Exactly. And I think that the word fiat means that by fiat, by rule of law, by order of the king, it can be decided, in the example of the United States, that a dollar is worth a dollar. And they just say it. And so it's by fiat. They hate fiat currencies. They hate government control of currencies. So they want to create a currency that's outside of that system. It also brings in a lot of people that wish we were back on the gold standard, that the dollar should be linked to gold. And almost everyone I've ever talked to about the gold standard is surprised to find out that for well over 100 years, maybe even longer, the U.S. dollar was not tied to gold in any way. It was linked to gold, and then it was unlinked to gold, and then it was linked to gold, and then unlinked to gold. And at one point, the Congress voted, while it was still linked, to change the ratio of gold that's needed for a dollar. So they're linking it to gold by fiat. So even though it's technically backed by a gold reserve, it's still an arbitrary relationship that the Congress can change at any time and make it linked or unlinked. So it's kind of a moot point, but people are going to bring that up. Ironically, Bitcoin is not tied to gold either. So I don't know why that attracts this group so much. But the inventors created a protocol, a bit of software, basically, that has a bunch of rules and define that one thing is that there's only going to be 21 million Bitcoins ever. And so they find that very appealing because there's a limited supply. And that supply is introduced over a long period of time, ending in about the year 2140. So it gets to be a smaller and smaller amount. So that, in theory, holds its value. It will not depreciate because there's not going to be any more of it at some point in time. So for the people who've been panicked by Fox News about fiscal stimulus, the United States government creating more cash, this at some point will never have more cash created, although most of the people who are excited about that probably won't be around in 2140 when it stops. So that's kind of a funny thing to think about. And the coins are given out to people who check the transactions. So before I get into that, I have to explain the transactions. So if I move money from a checking account to a savings account, my bank tracks that for me and I can log in and they tell me, and I'm dependent on them to tell me that my money moved from one location to another. If I pay my Visa bill, my bank will send money from my bank to the Visa card company, and it's all tracked and maintained by the banks. And this is another thing that people don't like: big banks. They don't want to be involved with banks. They just want to pay people and not have banks involved, not have governments involved. But the bank has a really strong motivation to be accurate and detailed and make sure everything happens the way it's supposed to happen. Because if you can't trust the bank, then they're going to go out of business. So the protocol for Bitcoin provides that all of the individual users can have access to every single transaction that has ever occurred and will ever occur. And that's called the master ledger or the fixed ledger. There's different words for it. And if you get involved with Bitcoin and you get a fancy schmancy, a high-end piece of hardware to mine, and we'll get into mining, you get a download first of every single transaction that's ever occurred, and you can audit it. And there's all these different things to it. And I'm getting ahead again because it's so complicated. It's trippy. A lot of the stuff that is promoted for Bitcoin, and this was funny because a lot of this, I'll just go through this. Payment freedom. We've talked about this. I can pay whoever I want without anyone knowing. Stability. It's a currency not affected by government policy. It won't go up and down. Well, we already know that's wrong. Security. It's safer than your local bank. No central control. Through the mining process or account verification, 6 different people have to verify your transaction. So that prevents double payments. That prevents people cheating the system, all those things. Another step, it's easy to use and everyone can understand it. Well, we have already shown that that's going to be a challenge. The transactions are almost spontaneous and they're free. And all of the transactions are completely transparent because everyone can see all the transactions, but yet they're secret. So you can see all the transactions, but they're secret. So there's a lot of stuff there that is promised. And so we're going to get into that. And one of the things that you need to understand, so there's going to have so many words, Seth, I'm so sorry. There's Bitcoin exchanges, and these exchanges can handle other cryptocurrencies because Bitcoin is not alone. And it's a place where you can buy and sell your Bitcoins to somebody else and turn it into the nasty, evil, dirty fiat money, US dollars. And they can also hold it for you. And the world's biggest currency exchange currently is Coinbase. A few years ago, the biggest one was called Mt. Gox, and we'll cover that later, what happened to them. The next thing is you need, instead of an account, what you have is a wallet. And so the wallet holds, you're glossing over. Am I losing you? I don't know how else to do this.
I'm watching The Last Jedi in my head, in the back of my head, Phil.
Misa.
Hang on just a second. Before you finish that. Bitcoin is, as a cryptocurrency, it's only in digital form, or are there actual coins that represent?
There's no physical representation of Bitcoin.
Right. So there's no actual coin in Bitcoin. Yeah. It's only a digital currency, for lack of a better way of saying.
And it's funny because every time you see a story about Bitcoins, they show pictures of Bitcoins.
Yeah, I did for the thumbnail of this broadcast. There's a Bitcoin. I was, just something catchy.
So. And it's in the name. It says coin, but it's not. So.
Okay. And not just anyone. Can anyone participate in these transactions, or must you pre-qualify or sign up, or how do I become someone who can use this currency?
Anyone can use it. And to do that, the simplest thing is that you would need a wallet. So I'll segue back into this. And the wallet is a bit of software that you can put on your PC, your Mac, or a lot of smartphones. And your wallet contains your Bitcoins or your fractions of Bitcoins. And you will have a public address. And the best analogy I've heard for this, again, and all analogies can break down if you get real technical, your public address is kind of like your email. So if I want to send an email to Seth, I send it to a certain string of numbers and letters together in a certain format, and I can send you information to your email. In this case, they're 34 characters long, which are alphanumeric, capital, lower cases, with 34 give or take characters, had different numbers on, different information on that, but that's about the length. So they're complicated addresses for you, but it's publicly known. Just like your email address is publicly known, but I cannot send an email as Seth. I can only send it as Phil because only I have the password to get into my email account, and that's called the private key. So I have a private key, which is very long and complicated, and then there's also a public key. So when I send money from my public address, I use my private key to encode it and encrypt the transaction, and a public key is created that you can see, that everyone else can see, and through an incredibly detailed and complicated mathematical calculation, you will be able to verify that I have the private key, but you won't be able to figure out my private key.
Now, is the complexity, and may I be jumping ahead here myself, is the complexity of the process and the concept a way to lock out, say, you know, everybody else? I mean, this is not the kind of thing where you just plunk down a buck and a half at the store to pick up a candy bar or whatever. I mean, there were all these steps.
It was. And the idea is that you can, you know, wave your cell phone over a reader, or you could translate online and you could buy your cup of Joe, you know, your $12 Starbucks, and you can pay with a fraction of a Bitcoin. And it's going to be fast and instantaneous and free. And no one knows you did it. So if you go to the local adult store and buy a dildo, no one's ever going to know you bought it. So it's all going to be safe and secure.
You know, we got 30 minutes into the show before the dildo reference. Thank you, Phil. Thanks for that.
And so now the problem is that this mathematical calculation that's used to verify that you have the private key and created this specific public key so that money can transfer, that has to be verified. And like I said, it's a very, very robust, complicated process. And that's what the miners do. So it first started with computers, your home computer. You could set up and become a miner and you could work on solving these problems. And when you solve the problem, you get rewarded with bitcoins. And it started out something like 25 bitcoins. And then at a certain date, it cut to half to 12 bitcoins. And I think it actually was 50, 25, and now it's 12. So if you're the first one to solve a block of these problems, and so a whole bunch of these will be bundled together and it's called a block. If you solve that entire block before anybody else in the entire world, thousands and thousands of people trying to solve this at the same time, whoever solves it first gets 12 and a half bitcoins. And if bitcoins are trading at $10, $15, $20,000 each, that's $120,000, $250,000 is your reward for being first to solve it. Now, it needs incredibly complicated and high-end power, which we're going to get to, but that's why people mine. That's why people verify these incredibly elaborate, complex transactions, because the payoff can be huge. The problem is that to do this, you need equipment. You need fancy and expensive equipment, and so many people are doing this, the odds that you actually solve anything ever first is so vanishingly small, you're never going to get your 12 and a half bitcoins. So what people do is they join a pool. And so you and other miners, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of miners, join together in a pool. And odds are somebody in that pool is going to solve it first and you all share in the goods. That makes sense?
It does make sense. It sort of sounds front-loaded for those who are, you know, techno savvy and computer savvy and have the resources for the gear to be able to do so. Even at on the individual level, it sounds to me like, you know, the spoils are going to go to those who happen to speak this particular language, right?
There is some merit to that, absolutely. And right now there's about 16.5 million bitcoins with a total of 20 million. In the last year, the number of bitcoins has increased by about 4%. So those people that are worried about the U.S. currency increasing by 3%, don't seem to mind there's new bitcoins coming in, which cracks me up. And the 12 and a half bitcoins are awarded approximately every 10 minutes. Now, when I kept finding this approximately, I'm like, what in the hell? Why 10 minutes? And so my understanding, and we may get corrections on this, is that the protocol is set up to make the mathematical calculation so difficult that when everyone in the world works on the problem, the first person is likely to solve it in about 10 minutes. Sometimes a block of transactions are solved in seconds. Someone got lucky. Sometimes it takes 90 minutes. If the average solving time is too quick because there's too many computers, too many processors, too many people solving the Bitcoin problems, they make the problems harder because they only want to give out the next block of next set of 12 and a half Bitcoins in 10 minutes. That's the target. So if people start solving it in 6, 7, 8 minutes, they get harder. If they are ended up solving it in 15, 20, 30 minutes because people drop out because the price falls and it's not worth the effort, then the problems become simpler. So the goal is to give out 12 and a half Bitcoins every 10 minutes. So as long as people can do that, the Bitcoins will keep flowing and the people will keep processing.
Was that tone someone who was complaining about sending you hate mail about Bitcoin?
Yeah, it's one of those evil things that Facebook is impossible to silence, and I just muted the whole tab.
So don't worry about it. I just, when I heard the tone, I thought, well, it's begun. You know, Bitcoin apocalypse has begun. Well, what happens when all of the Bitcoin that's going to be created is, and it simply becomes about transference from one?
Well, like I said, that's not going to happen until 2140. So that's a long way away. And an interesting thing about the pools that you have to join, I mean, you don't have to, but you could buy all this equipment and spend all this time and effort and never, ever, ever solve a block first. Oh, and the other word that you'll hear all the time is blockchain. And so the block of transactions, once they're all solved, they get added to this chain that includes every transaction throughout all of history. And that becomes a permanent record of everything that has happened. The pools. So for example, the largest pool in the world is called Ant Pool, like the little insect Ant Pool. They also make a lot of the high-end hardware that you can buy to actually play in this game and become a miner, which means you're verifying and trying to solve these incredibly complex mathematical calculations with the hope that you're going to get 12 and a half Bitcoins. They control 28% of the market and they're based in China. And I've read some things allegedly that all of the hardware that they sell has a little bit of code in the software that at any point in time, they can disable all those machines and eliminate their competition. I don't know if it's true or not. It's way beyond my capacity to verify. But that's some of the gamesmanship that goes on. The next biggest one is F2 pool. That's 21% of the market. Guess where that's located?
China.
Oh, you're good at this game.
Well, you know.
The next one is BTCC. That's 13% of the market. It's in China. Then one of the smaller ones is called Slush Pool, and that's in the Czech Republic. And there's also some of these in Russia and other countries around the world, including the United States. But depending on the day and who you look at, China controls anywhere from 58 to 68% of all of the Bitcoin mining pools. That becomes a problem a little later on, and I'll explain it.
Have you seen the articles that have been talking about the concern about the amount of computational resources being used, all this mining, all these? I mean, there's a concern about the amount of computing resources that are being allocated just for Bitcoin. Have you seen any of those?
I haven't. That's in here, too.
Okay.
And before we get to that.
All right. Don't let me jump ahead of you, my friend. No, go ahead.
I've got a plan.
All right.
Make this make sense.
I'm on your train. You drive.
All right. Okay, but you know, it's good to remind me. I want to stop for a minute on Bitcoin and talk about some financial terms that people that are Bitcoin aficionados, fans, use, and they use them incorrectly. And so one of the words is intrinsic value. And I point this out all the time that Bitcoins do not have an intrinsic value. And so there's a lot of confusion about what that means. So if you look at a stock of a company like Caterpillar, they have factories, they have plants, they have equipment that they own, they have tools, they have money in the bank, they have a lot of different things. You can look at that, you can calculate their cash flow, you can look at the profits in the past, and you can try to calculate the intrinsic value of that stock. It's very difficult to do, but you can be in the ballpark. And that drives a lot of fundamental analysis where people try to figure out what a stock is worth. And if you calculate that it's worth $50 a share and it's on the market for 40, you're inclined to buy it. If you calculate that it's worth 30 and it's $40 on the market, you're inclined to not buy it. There's no way to do that with Bitcoin. Bitcoin is only worth what it last sold for, and that's the trading price. So I've asked people for evidence of the intrinsic value of Bitcoin, and they send me a screenshot of the trading price. Well, the trading price is not the intrinsic value. Just like we talked about the stock that might be trading at 40, but all of the things that it owns and all the cash flow that it's worth might only be worth 30. The prices are different. Another thing that is used is the word risk. Risk in the investment world is a mathematical measurement of the ups and downs or volatility in an investment. Bitcoin has gone up and down an awful lot. So by definition, the way the word is used, it's risky. Doesn't mean you'll make money or not make money, but volatility is defined through standard deviation as risk. And so people will tell me, well, if I can make 2,000% in 1 year, there's no risk. Well, the stock price, if the price goes up and down, it's risky. That's what those words mean. It's kind of like a creationist saying it's only a theory. And they change the definition of the words. I'm going to go into production cost here. This is what the miners might have to deal with to generate Bitcoins. And so this, again, is different than the other costs. This is the cost to produce a Bitcoin currently. And this is changing very, very rapidly. First of all, a high-end Antminer S9, that's the current high-end model made by the Antminer company I mentioned before in China. They've created unique chips and systems that are more efficient and use less electricity to try to mine Bitcoins. The cost in electricity alone to mine 0.9 Bitcoins over the period of a year can be anywhere from $1,200 to $1,800 for one machine. And this machine will cost you $3,000 list, but surprise, they're sold out. And so in other places, they're selling anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 a piece. So you've got to buy this $5,000 to $10,000 piece of hardware. Make sure you have the right software. Make sure you have a lot of freaking electricity. Make sure that you have cooling. You have to use your labor to set it up. You have to have a location to set it up, because if you set it up in your house and you're not in Canada or someplace really north like Russia or northern China, it's going to heat up your apartment like nobody's business, and air conditioning can't keep up with it. So you have to have specialized ventilation. Sometimes they break. Sometimes you have to have repairs. You have to change wires. You have to solder things. So the production cost to mine a Bitcoin currently is between $4,000 and $8,000 per coin. But if you can generate a coin for $8,000 and sell it on the market for $16,000, you made a lot of money. Now, it might take you a whole year to do it. And with a very volatile price, it might not be worth $16,000 a year from now. And you're stuck with a machine that has no value to do anything else. What do you think?
It's the undiscovered country, right? It's the great unknown, the future. We have no idea what the implications are. Someone can go all in with the hopes of, you know, sort of an underground currency, right? They're trying to stick it to the man. They're trying to circumvent the big banks. I understand their aversion to many of these often crooked financial institutions. They're wanting to create their own system. There's a system of regulations in place, supposedly, apparently, but no one knows what it is going to do. But I've seen predictions of, hey, this is something you got to jump on. This is the bandwagon to be on, and do it now before it's too late, right?
Well, that's very common. And there are definitely people who have, in a very short period of time, have become millionaires in this. No doubt about it. The question, I don't have a time machine. It'd be nice to have a hot tub time machine. If I could go back a year and put 20 or 50 or 100,000 in Bitcoins and then sell them now, I'd be really happy. But I can't go back, just like I can't go back and bet on that horse that was 50 to 1. And if you bet $10,000 on a horse that's 50 to 1, you're going to make a lot of money. Still doesn't mean it's an investment. It means that you won that bet. What's the next bet? What's that horse going to do the next time? I'm going to segue into the next topic, or not so segue, just go to the next topic, is liquidity. One of the things is that these are easy to move and to trade and to transfer. The problem is, as the demand has increased, these blocks that are designed to be processed once every 10 minutes, you have more and more transactions, so more and more transactions have to be delayed. So the transactions won't happen in 10 minutes. They'll happen in 20, 30, 60 minutes. You might have to wait 4 or 5 blocks. And there have been reports of people waiting up to a day or longer for a simple transaction to go through, because the amount of transactions that are being done in a fixed period of time based on those mathematical models that get harder or easier, and they're only going to get harder, will force it to stay at 10 minutes for a block of data of a certain size to be solved.
Now, by transaction, do you mean someone is spending a Bitcoin in some way? I mean, I've noticed there are actually some major retailers who are now accepting Bitcoin, just like they would Visa, MasterCard, et cetera.
And some of them are, so they can collect collect the Bitcoins on their own and start filling their wallet, the word we learned earlier. But if they want to then liquidate them for dollars, they're going to have to sell them to somebody. And that's going to have to go through. And actually, all those other transactions are going to all have to clear through the blockchain. And so you can have a delay of a day or two. And as a retailer, you don't want to be sitting on a lot of Bitcoins when the price is jumping up and down 20% in hours or days. So one of the ways people have solved this and how they push their transactions to the top is they start paying a transaction fee. And it first started out 25, 50 cents. And as the system becomes more and more bogged down, the fee goes higher and higher if you really want a transaction to go through.
Now, wait, aren't we starting to see an emulation of the fiat system? I mean, because it's the affluent who are going to get preferential treatment, right?
Well, in some ways, but I mean, if you want to sell one Bitcoin, and it's so funny because even though this is going to go out only days after we're recording it, I don't know what they're going to be when this comes out. But let's just say a Bitcoin is $16,000. If you have to pay $28 to get that to sell and to get that processed in the next 10 minutes, what do you care? It's $20. But it now becomes not viable as a currency. I'm not going to buy a $5 Starbucks coffee. Well, I guess $10 for our Starbucks coffee, if I might have to pay a $28 fee to get it processed. And Starbucks may not want to take the Bitcoins from me. So this is a problem. And you could still pay no fee, but now you're just going to have to wait. And as more people are more willing to pay fees because the value of the Bitcoins have gone up, if you don't pay a fee, you're going to wait longer and longer. So just in this year, the fees have gone from 25 to 50 cents to 4 to 8 to 12. And today it's $28 is the average. And if you want it to go even faster, you cough up 40, 50 bucks and you go right to the top of the line. Because whoever solves the equation that includes your transaction, they get that fee. And so now not only are they getting Bitcoins, but they're getting paid fees. If the price of Bitcoins falls to below $8,000 or $10,000 a Bitcoin, it now could cost more to mine it than it's worth to find it. And so now your only value is by collecting fees with these $3,000 and $5,000 and $7,000 machines, so the transaction costs will go even higher.
Doesn't this create a scenario where big ticket items tend to be where Bitcoin's playground is? I mean, if you're not buying the $5 coffee, you're going to be buying the ticket where, you know, if you have a $30 transaction fee, a $50 transaction fee, it's less of a hit, right?
Yeah, and you know, so if you want to buy a intercontinental plane ticket or you want to pay for some cargo to smuggle drugs from one country to another, Bitcoin's your ideal thing to do. And you don't care about a $28 or $30 charge. Another thing is that Bitcoins are going to be used by everybody, but 40% of all the world's Bitcoins are owned by 1,000 people. And so there's a bottleneck there. I went to a place called Coin Central. It's a blog about Bitcoins, and it's talking about transactions taking 16 to 24 hours, and the fees are going up. And so if people want to, you know, check that, they can. Another thing is that people have developed, at least conceptually, the way to hack Bitcoin or attack Bitcoin. And I'm not talking about going and stealing a Bitcoin, but to bring down the whole system. And one of these has to do, I'm definitely outside of my expertise here, so I'm not going to cover this real quick, but if you can do what's called a border gateway protocol hijack and control IP addresses, you can slow down even further the transactions of Bitcoins, and you might slow them down so much that you can cause a problem called double spend, where I can use the same Bitcoins twice or three times before my first transaction is ever confirmed. if people are allowed to double and triple spend the same Bitcoins, the system falls apart because now I can't trust it. It's like me making a photocopy of a 20 and handing it to you, but you can't look at it for an hour. And meanwhile, I leave your store and I spend another 20. By the time you figure out it's not legitimate and the transaction doesn't clear, I'm gone. So you're going to stop taking 20s. So that's another problem. There's more, way more on that if you want to research it. Another thing to look at, Bitcoins today, as of the time we're recording this, if you take all the Bitcoins that exist times the current traded price, Bitcoins have a market value of about $300 billion. And that's a lot of money for something that has no intrinsic value. Now, if it's a currency, it doesn't matter. If it's an investment, we have a problem. $300 billion, just for reference, that is bigger in market cap than either Walmart, AT&T, Coca-Cola, or Walt Disney.
Is this one of those perception is reality things? I mean, what if public perception, what if public confidence in Bitcoin changes? Does that change the value at all, or are these hard numbers?
Absolutely. It's staggering because, and they can point this out for a fiat currency. For example, if everyone loses complete confidence in the U.S. dollar, which if we get to that point in the next couple of years, the world's in chaos and you better have a gun. Because, I mean, full shitstorms, you know, it's over, right? It's the apocalypse. It's over. The other thing is that you can look at that money, and that $300 billion is worth more than all U.S. currency in the United States held by the Federal Reserve, all banks, all checking, and all savings accounts. Right? So it's absolutely staggering. In 2 years, if Bitcoin continues at the rate that it is, and I'm under the impression that's not going to happen, it will be worth more than all the cash in all the world held in every single checking savings account and by every bank.
Most of which would be controlled by China, you're saying?
Well, that's a different risk. But yeah, it's another thing. Another topic that I get in arguments with about Bitcoin aficionados is taxes. Currently, I'm not aware of anything that says Bitcoins are illegal per se, but if you bought Bitcoins for $1,000 and they're now worth $200,000, and you made a lot of money, congratulations. If you sell that, you're going to have to pay capital gains on it. So you made $199,000. If your marginal tax bracket is 28%, you're going to owe $56,000 in taxes. One of the perks of something like Bitcoin is it's supposed to be not traceable, right? So you made this money, no big deal. No one knows I made it. It's got my private key and my public key, and no one can ever find out that I made this money. So you're safe. Well, I think you're a fool if you think it's that easy. Because if you suddenly show up with $200,000 in cash in your U.S. checking account, and you can't explain where it comes from, you are potentially in a shithole. And it's going to get ugly because not only is the IRS going to audit you and want to know where this money came from, but you could have just committed tax evasion and tax fraud by not declaring it.
Does that speak to maybe the grand irony of Bitcoin is that at the end of the day, don't many people want to take this cryptocurrency and translate it into the fiat currency? They want to translate it into an actual dollar. So while they're busy circumventing the system, they're actually wanting to make money using the system, right?
Well, this is one of those arguments that the more valuable Bitcoins become, the less like a currency they are. And I saw a comedian, I can't remember, it was a funny YouTube video that just came out off. I shared it on my wall, but he said, fiat currency is useless. And so I bought Bitcoins and they went up a ton in fiat currency, which I don't care about, but I have the same amount of Bitcoin currency, which I do care about.
Yeah, it's hard to get your head around. You're circumventing the system while relying on the system at the same time.
I say anyone that tells me they made 2,000% in Bitcoins means they still think in U.S. dollars. They don't see Bitcoin as a currency. They see it as an investment, as a way to get more dollars while they proclaim that dollars are not a value. It's an amusing thing. Go ahead.
Phil Ferguson, is there anything that else that we need to know about Bitcoin before I have you sort of put a bow on it? I mean, I want to know if you can encapsulate kind of what you think. Your opinion as someone who plays the game. Well, anything else we need to know?
I was afraid we'd get to this point because I've only covered about half. And so what I'll do is I'll wrap up. But I'll make a longer second segment of this that people can find on my show after your show comes out.
Cool. And I'll go back and link to it in the description box. You bet.
That's the Phil Ferguson Show. So if you're bored out of your freaking mind, just stop here and I'll wrap up with Bo. And I know that includes Seth because I can
not see. Not at all. I'm honestly fascinated by this stuff.
But other things that we have problems, we have what's called the 51% problem, because in a way, Bitcoin is a democracy. So if somebody or some farms or pools can contain more than 51% of the processing power, they can start controlling and manipulating the transactions. So there's that. And I've got more information on that. Theft, the first place we had was Mt. Gox, had 70% of the exchange in 2013. They lost at the time $450 million worth of Bitcoins and they went out of business. Last year we had Bitfinex that lost a whole bunch of money because they got hacked and individual clients got hacked. And they decided that every client, whether they got hacked or not, should share in the pain, and everyone lost 36% of their money, even though their specific account didn't get hacked. So that's good fun. Last month was NiceHash, and just recently another company called Ubit got hacked and may have lost 17 to 25% of all of its clients' assets in 2 hours. The other thing is that with electricity, which you hinted at, as the processing power goes up and as people chase this money, the demand for electricity is going to grow exponentially. And so let me give you some examples. The country of Venezuela has now been suffering brownouts and blackouts caused by Bitcoin mining. By July of 2019, the Bitcoin network could use more electricity than is generated in the United States of America. It is calculated that by February of 2020, all of the Bitcoin miners could use more power than is currently generated by the whole fucking planet. This is unsustainable. Retail purchases, Steam, the gaming platform online, has said that they will no longer accept Bitcoin because of the volatile nature. They don't know if they're going to get rid of them or not. There's new issues. Companies and new coins are being issued. One came up called, what is this name? Confido, which starts with con, which is hysterical. They sold $375,000 of coins at an initial public offering, and then the company closed and the money disappeared. Another one called Ether had a bug in the code, and $300 million of the currency went to one user who panicked and tried to send it back and did it wrong, and it all disappeared. Because if you lose your private key, your money is gone. So if you have $500,000 of any cryptocurrency in an account, in a wallet, and you lose your key, it's gone.
It's just like you just poured kerosene on it and lit the match.
That's right.
Hurts the heart to think about it. He was this close. He was this
another
close.
Topic I have called is called fork you. There's been what's called a hard fork, where there was a schism in Bitcoin, just like in religion. And there's now Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash. I'll go into that in my segment, which is hysterical on and of its own. And as of my research date, there are currently 1,365 individual cryptocurrencies. And there was a company set up called the Crypto Company, which was starting to build pools of cryptocurrencies so that you can invest without buying the currencies, and they take all that risk for you. They have now been halted. Their trading has been halted on the U.S. Stock Exchange because of the beliefs of insider trading. There was a company that makes juice, fruit juices, that was rumored to go into cryptocurrency, and their stock went up 200% in a couple days. So I'm just going to summary here on all these things we talked about, the beautiful things of cryptocurrency. You have payment freedom, which you don't have anymore. You have stability, which you don't have. You have security, that's dubious. No central control. It's possible either by the mining pools or by ISP address control. Easy to use. Did you understand everything? I'm sure there's some listeners that, you know, this is a lot of stuff. Free transactions, that's gone. Transparent, but secret. No, the IRS just won a court case and is going to collect something like 14,000 client accounts from Coinbase in the United States. And they're going to start looking for people who aren't paying taxes. And that's just the beginning. I got much, much more. My apologies for going long.
Not at all. Honestly, it's a compelling hour, my friend. Hey, I like remember back in, was it the mid-90s when they were talking about, we are just a few years away from the paperless office. Everything is going to be digital. We're doing away with paper.
That's never going to happen.
And we hear the same thing about currency, right? I mean, at some point, we're going to be only in a digital world. Is that more of a reality, and is it something you like?
I think we could go really, really close to paperless currency. And maybe it's going to be a cryptocurrency. I don't know. If it becomes popular enough, why not the U.S. government create U.S. crypto? And then it's a cryptocurrency that's controlled by the United States government. But the current model of Bitcoin is, it can't succeed. As it scales, it becomes more and more obscene. It just can't function.
It's going to collapse under its own weight or what? What are we talking about?
And matter of fact, there's concern right now. I mean, today, I mean, I am predicting a bubble, and this is not something I normally do. Bitcoin is going to collapse and is going to go down to a fraction of what it's currently worth. And some of that money is going to rush into other cryptocurrencies. One of them is going to be Bitcoin Cash and Ethereum. One of the ones that failed was Ether, which is hysterical because the money went into the Ether. But those are likely to be dragged down with it. As confidence falls, it's like you said, as long as people think that this is valuable, it is. But as soon as some people start saying, you know what, I made a lot of money, I want to lock in my profits and turn it back into the real fake fiat currency, US dollars, which I can spend anywhere easily. If a few people start heading towards the gates, and I got other information that I'll have in a longer show of why that may already be starting, but that's the teaser to go to the Phil Ferguson show. Yeah. And I'll have this. And what I'll do is I'll take a little break and then go back and address the rest of it. I can't believe I only got through half of this stuff. I'm so sorry. I had too much.
No, it was fantastic. I'm going to release this full broadcast on my regular podcast on the YouTube as well. And then Phil's going to release this same first hour in a few days on his, and then a part two, and I'll go back and add the links and whatnot. Interesting stuff, though. And again, it's skeptical money. We as skeptics want to keep our eyes and ears open. It's kind of a real world thing that people are talking about. Why not talk about it on this show? And do you really find the correlation, sometimes some crossover between religion and finance? People often will talk about investments in almost a religious way. Do you see that?
I do. And the old school way that I've seen it is somebody that, they'll talk about faith-based investing, and they'll do investments based on Bible. And I know we could do a whole show on that, right? But it is funny because some of the faith-based investing is fantastic. Like they might say you should buy and hold, and then they find a Bible verse that when you tilt your head and wink a certain way says that you should buy and hold. So like anything with the Bible or any religious text, you come up with what you want to believe, and then you can find something that kind of supports it. That's what they do. So Bible-based investing by itself is not necessarily bad. It's just hokey as fuck. And it's a big goofy thing. I just recently talked to someone about a mutual fund that only invests in companies that are biblically sound.
And good luck qualifying that one. What is biblically sound?
And it's funny because I've done segments on socially conscious mutual funds. And one extreme example is that one fund might not buy stock in Apple because they employ children in China. Another fund might buy Apple because they provide job opportunities for children in China. So who decides what the rules are? They're all different. They're all flexible. And the funny thing is with these things, and I'll just drop this bomb here, let them go to my show and check it out. If you buy a socially responsible mutual fund, you're not doing any good anyway. It's a marketing gimmick, and I explain that in different shows, and they can go check that out. It's hysterical.
I'm going to need some Excedrin, Phil.
And futile that attempt is.
Or maybe a stiff drink. I don't know. Phil Ferguson, I'm going to make sure and link your site and show in the description box. A compelling conversation. You can send your email to randomdildoreference@thephilfergusonshow.com. Just funny. I'm still stuck on that. Yeah. Phil, you're always fun to talk to. Phil's a good guy. He's he's one of those people that I bump into from time to time out there at the conference circuit. And he's the only guy I've really met so far who can do an hour on stage in finance-related issues. And he has everybody on the end of their seat, and they're all laughing, and occasionally they're terrified, all at the same time. And then when he takes them to the darkest depths and shatters their dreams, at the end of the speech, he puts a photo of a kitten on the screen.
You got to have a little break from the anxiety.
Life is balance. Phil Ferguson, thanks for your time and your perspective. Thank you, great conversation, my friend.
Ciao.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.